The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Yesterday, Israeli police released a video showing a Palestinian man ramming his company car into a group of Jews waiting at a bus stop in Jerusalem. The terrorist then jumped out of his car, waving a meat cleaver, and he started hacking at one of his victims. And in response to this, and in response to several other vicious terrorist attacks in Israel yesterday, the U.S. State Department immediately called on both sides to take affirmative steps to restore calm and prevent actions that would further escalate tensions. That's a quote from the State Department site. The Palestinians, in other words, must tone it down, and so must the Jews. The Jews who are being attacked. Yesterday, Associated Press reporter Matt Lee, he asked a State Department spokesman about what the administration means by calling on Israel, by calling on the Palestinians and Israel to de-escalate the situation. Here's an excerpt from that exchange.
Does the United States believe, does the administration believe that Israel is inciting or not condemning violence?
I think what we've been very clear about saying is that we want to see both sides take affirmative steps, affirmative actions that reduce tensions in the region. And that we've seen, we've seen horrific attacks, obviously, today. You saw our statement earlier condemning those attacks. But we've seen also attacks on Palestinians the investigations remain ongoing that have taken place now 3 or 4 weeks ago.
And so the Palestinians rise up on a so-called day of rage. And they start killing Jews. And the United States immediately kicks off another round of this moral equivalence game. That this is just the same old cycle of violence with plenty of fault to go around, with plenty of fault on both sides. Both sides need to decrease the tensions that are leading to the ongoing incidents of violence. That's what that spokesman said yesterday as part of that exchange. The AP reporter then pressed him to explain what he believed Israel needed to do in order to decrease the tensions. Here's yet another excerpt from that exchange.
Can you explain what it is that you're not satisfied with from the Israeli government in terms of condemning violence and combating incitement?
It's not, I mean, you're saying that we're not satisfied. I think that our consistent,
I mean, if the secretary is calling up both Abbas and Netanyahu and has the same message for both of them, it would suggest that you think that both of them need to do more today. And I'm just trying to figure out what is it you would want the Israelis to do.
Upholding the status quo in Haram al-Sharif and Temple Mount.
But has there been?
Notice that last statement there. That's actually the United States Department of State giving credence to the lie that Arab propagandists have been repeating over and over again over the past several weeks, that these dirty Jews are secretly planning to blow up mosques, secretly planning to desecrate the Muslim holy sites. I mentioned what the PA chairman, Mahmoud Abbas, said about a month ago. on Palestinian TV. Al-Aqsa is ours, he said. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is ours. He said the Jews have no right to defile them with their filthy feet. We will not allow them to. And we will do everything in our power to protect Jerusalem. That's what he said just on September the 16th, less than a month ago. We'll do everything in our power to protect Jerusalem. And so, this is what Palestinian terrorists have been doing for the past 2 weeks, protecting Jerusalem by stabbing, slashing, ramming, burning, and beating Jews all across Israel. And both sides are expected by the United States to reduce tensions. Israel, too, needs to tone it down by maintaining the status quo on the Temple Mount. That's what the Obama administration believes, that Israel is somehow ending or perhaps threatening to end a decades-long policy that has consistently worked to protect and preserve all the holy sites in Israel, whether Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. That's been the track record since Israel gained control of East Jerusalem and the Temple Mount in 1967. It's a revealing statement, though, made by that spokesman, that one thing Israel needs to do is to maintain the status quo, as if it isn't doing that. Which, as I say, just gives credibility to this lie that the Arab propagandists are out there spreading through social media circles and other ways. Notice what U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry had to say. This was in a discussion at Harvard last night.
What's happening is that unless we get going, a two-state solution could conceivably be stolen from everybody. And there's been a massive increase in settlements over the course of last years. Now you have this violence because there's a frustration that is growing. And a frustration among Israelis who don't see any movement. So I look at that and I say, if that did explode, and I pray and hope it won't, and I think there are options to prevent that, but we would inevitably be, at some point, we're going to have to be engaged in working through those kinds of difficulties.
He said, now you have this violence because there is a frustration. There's all these settlement increases. There's the peace process that's been stalled. And it's because people are so frustrated that you have this violence. Over the past 2 weeks, 7 Israelis have been murdered, and many more have been injured in at least 26 terrorist attacks in Israel. And yet the leading diplomats, spokesmen in the United States would have us believe that these murderers are just frustrated, that they just want a two-state solution, that they just want to make peace with Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think he said this on Monday, that terror does not come because of frustration over the peace process. He said terror comes from the desire to annihilate. The desire to annihilate us. Look at what the Palestinians themselves are saying. They've called this uprising the Hibat al-Quds, or the Jerusalem Awakening. They're calling this the Jerusalem Awakening. They're responding to this Jewish conspiracy the way they see it, to desecrate the holy sites, to destroy the mosques, to take over the Temple Mount. And so because of this, there is the Jerusalem Awakening. In Commentary Magazine, this piece I think is from yesterday or the day before, it says, read any of the accounts of the motivations of the people going into the streets to stab random Jews they encounter, or the mobs in the West Bank who are seeking to set off confrontations with Israeli troops, and you don't hear much about frustration about the peace process. What you do see are accounts of Muslim religious fervor that is drenched in the fever of martyrdom and faith-based hate. That's what you see if you just look at what they're saying. Who's right? Mr. Netanyahu says it's hatred, a desire to annihilate, that's fueling this violence. Those among the American leadership, they say it's frustration. Commentary writes, this is significant, and not just because most of the popular notion that the violence is caused by the failure of Israel to make enough concessions in negotiations to bring peace. It says, if Palestinians are engaged in an intifada that is, at its core, a religious war rather than a protest movement about Israeli policies or a desire for a Palestinian state, then everything that the Obama administration and even many of Israel's American supporters think they know about the conflict is just plain wrong. It's just plain wrong. And so that's why you get so much of the reporting that we get. I saw a piece from the BBC just this morning. I guess it played last night, saying that so many of these youths that are out there spearheading the violence, that they were born after the Oslo peace process even got started. And so what is it that's causing them? They know little or nothing about the frustrations of their fathers. Supposing they were frustrated over a lagging peace process, or the inability to get a two-state solution in place. And so what is it that's fueling the anger among these youths, these 16, 17, 18-year-olds? It surely must be the Israeli policies. That's all that he could conclude. This is a BBC reporter on the news here in the UK last night. Well, yesterday we talked a little bit about the significance of what we're now seeing unfold in Jerusalem and across Israel. What is the significance of this Jerusalem Awakening and all of this violence aimed at Jews? Why is there so much hatred aimed at the Jews today? Not just in Jerusalem, not just in Israel, but all around the world. Well, you have to keep in mind, as we've brought out so many times before, that the whole world is deceived by the devil. The whole world, Revelation 20 and verse 3, says that he's deceived the nations, plural. He's doing everything he can, Satan is, to fight against God, to fight against God's purpose, to blind the world to God's truth. Now, on the other hand, consider God's purpose, God's plan. God's purpose shall stand. This world is cut off from God. That's the choice that Adam and Eve made in the Garden of Eden. And since that time, man has been under a 6,000-year sentence. Cut off from God, left to go it alone. Under the influence and power of Satan the devil, the god of this world. God's purpose, though, is to reproduce himself through man. God is building a family. God is a family. And that family starts with Jesus Christ, the Son, who, when coming in the flesh, was born of a Jewish woman. Jesus Christ grew up as a Jewish boy. In Revelation 5, Jesus Christ is called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. During his earthly ministry, Jesus said, "Salvation is of the Jews." Now, this obviously doesn't mean that salvation is for physical Jews only. God is no respecter of persons. God is bringing salvation to the whole world. Salvation is for everyone. And yet God accomplishes this, as I discussed briefly yesterday, by converting all of mankind. It's brought about by all of mankind becoming spiritual Jews. "He is a Jew," Romans 2 says. "He is a Jew, which is one inwardly." This is right at the heart and core of God's purpose. My father wrote in the Key of David booklet, "Satan the devil understands the plan of God. He has a great hatred for God. Because of the plan of God, the word Jew can really stir up Satan's wrath. The Jews are a type of what all men, note that, all men are to become spiritually." This is the plain Bible truth. It comes right out of your Bible. In verses like what I've rattled off here, Revelation 5, John 4, 22, yesterday we read Romans 2, 28 and 29. My father says here, "It is God's association with the Jews that has turned Satan even more violently against them. Hatred for the Jews has been inspired by Satan. He knows that he was never offered what has been offered to mankind. He wants nothing more than to destroy the plan of God. That is Satan's objective. It is Satan's hatred for God's master plan that fuels his hatred for Jews. That's the truth. That's what's fueling this intense, violent, irrational hatred for one particular race." Now, racism, of course, is a huge problem all over the earth. If you want to get to root causes, again, you go to the devil and his influence, and you look at the nature of man, the hostility toward God and his law. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, Romans 8 and verse 7, and other verses like it that talk about that carnal nature. Now, coming back to the way America responded yesterday to all of this violence, this wave of terror, think about America's knee-jerk reaction. Here you have all of these acts of brutality. A Palestinian man who worked for an Israeli company, Bezek International. He's driving the company car. He's carrying a meat cleaver in the front seat. He comes around a corner and steps on the gas and aims for a crowd of Jews. He smashes into the crowd. He jumps out and starts hacking away. And there were multiple incidents like this just yesterday. And yet, America's knee-jerk response, well, now we're calling on both sides to calm down. We condemn violence on both sides. We mourn the loss of individuals from both sides. Why is America's response so significant? Well, because prophecy tells us that in these latter days, you're going to see these brother nations, and they have been as close as brothers historically ever since the founding of the Jewish state in 1948. These have been close, brotherly allies. But today we see the bands that held that brotherhood together breaking apart, like it says in Zechariah 11. We've talked about that prophecy a number of times at thetrumpet.com. And also one in Isaiah 9 that talks about Ephraim and Manasseh. That's the United States and Britain. Ephraim and Manasseh joining together to fight against Judah, to fight against the Jewish state, to fight against the Jewish tribe. Manasseh shall devour Ephraim, all kinds of infighting, and Ephraim and Manasseh, and together they shall be against Judah. Together they're against Judah. And so you have all these acts of terror that, as I said yesterday, this was brought out in a column at the Telegraph, in any other city, imagine a wave of terror in any other nation, in any other capital city of that nation, and then the knee-jerk response of the so-called friends of that nation being, well, now you need to tone it down too. You've brought quite a lot of this on yourself, keep in mind. It's only with Israel. Only Israel is held to this kind of, well, can you even call it a standard? It's bizarre. It's irrational. It doesn't make sense. You can't explain it. Unless you understand that there is a devil, unless you understand a little bit about God's purpose, unless you understand about God's plan for man, for every race, for every nation. Now, finally, what else can we take away from this? Where are these events leading? These events in the Middle East, these events surrounding Jerusalem, where is the Jerusalem awakening leading? Well, look at the prophecy in Zechariah 14. We referred to this just recently. God says, behold, the day of the Lord comes, and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. And the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity. God gives us here in Zechariah 14 the big overview of events leading right up to the return of Christ, before which God says, I'll gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. This is referring to when Jesus Christ returns and when he gathers his armies. And right before that, this prophecy here says, the city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. This is talking about when the king of the north conquers Jerusalem. Shortly after he conquers the king of the south, that's talked about in Daniel 11 and verse 40. And before that, you have half the city of Jerusalem going forth into captivity. So we've been telling you for years, years and years, to watch Jerusalem. To watch what happens in Jerusalem. Because Jerusalem will trigger a series of events. Zechariah 14 says so. A series of events that culminates in the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. That's also discussed in Zechariah 14. Read the whole chapter. Well, coming back to the significance of this latest wave of terror, of violence. You need to think also about the prophecy in Hosea 5 and verse 13, where it talks about Judah's wound and how that when Judah sees its wound and that it's incurable, it's going to go to the Assyrians for help. Germany, modern-day Germany. It's been more than two decades now. And look at that wound, that gaping wound. As we've seen since 1993, the Palestinians use the peace process to gradually weaken and undermine Israel's position. And we've seen it play out time and time and time again. Israel makes one concession, Israel pulls back, Israel lays down its arms, Israel keeps bargaining, and meanwhile the terrorists keep pushing. The terrorist leaders keep lying. It's a great conspiracy. They're coming to take over the Temple Mount. We've got to rise up. We have to awaken. This is the Jerusalem awakening. It's been a slow and steady, not so slow in some cases, push to liberate Jerusalem, to annihilate the Jews. Let me just give you a quote from one of our publications back in 2004. This is a little over 10 years old now. It's from our Royal Vision magazine. We wrote, if the brotherhood between superpower America and the Jewish state is broken, that's probably when half of Jerusalem would be taken. When Israel's enemies, you see, when they see that brotherhood broken, when they see Israel without allies, that just emboldens the terrorists. It says the Arabs would realize the Jews have no one supporting them. And then Judah really will see their wound. I think they're already beginning to see it. What has the peace process brought to Israel other than more trouble and violence? It's made them more vulnerable. Certainly hasn't produced peace. And so they'll eventually, the prophecies say, they'll eventually go running into the arms of Germany. And of course, this will be a tragic mistake. When we come back, I want to look at an article by Victor Davis Hanson, expanded out a little bit to the Middle East. I'd like to examine this article he wrote recently, The Road to Middle East Perdition. We'll look at that after the break. This is the Trumpet Daily radio show on 101.3 KPCG. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show. The relatively new science of archaeology, the digging up and study of the material remains of man's past, has confirmed without question the historical accuracy of the Bible. solid, documented evidence, apart from the Bible, confirms events and persons that at one time were known to us only from Scripture. The Bible is real, and you need to pay attention to it. Call now and request your free copy of The Authority of the Bible. This lesson, which comes from the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, blows the dust off your Bible. You will learn how to mine the treasures buried in the greatest book on earth. You can discover its secrets and enrich your life today. For more information, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Next week on this program, Brad McDonald is going to be spending a little bit of time on Russia's advance in Syria. As I mentioned the other day, we've been away from the microphone for a while, and of course there was a lot that happened. We need to talk some, too, about the Pope's visit to the United States recently. There was, of course, a huge story in that a week or two ago, and we need to comment some on that as well. So there's more to come on these major, major developments. But this piece here, as I mentioned before the break, Victor Davis Hanson's article, The Road to Middle East Perdition, he asks here, how did Vladimir Putin, with his country reeling from falling oil prices, possessing only a second-rate military, in demographic freefall, and suffering from an array of international sanctions, find himself the new playmaker in the Middle East? How did this happen? How is Russia taking the lead, as weak as its economy has been, its second-rate military, in demographic freefall? It says Putin's ascendancy was not foreordained. It followed a series of major U.S. miscalculations and blunders of such magnitude that it almost seems they must have been deliberate. It's an interesting comment there at the end. It almost seems as if it's been deliberate. A deliberate approach, strategy, agenda. Well, Hanson brings out a number of points that have contributed to this dramatic transformation across the Middle East, the road to Middle East perdition. He talks first about the reset with Putin, the infamous reset. You remember this from early on in the Obama administration. Well, let's hit the reset button. Let's get a do-over. Let's start over and make our relations good. Hanson says, naturally then, he saw, this is Putin, what he saw in the reset, he saw the Obama-Clinton reset grandstanding as more critical of America's past behavior than of Russia's present aggression, a fact that fueled Putin's further calculations that he could safely move into Crimea and Ukraine. That's the way he interpreted the reset, that this was more criticism of America's own behavior than it was Russia's. The apology tour, in other words. We're sorry for all that we've done during that previous administration. Now we're here to make it better. This is a new chapter. This is a fresh start. And he saw that as an opportunity to safely move forward into Crimea, into Ukraine, without any U.S. resistance whatsoever. Hanson also talks about the U.S. departure from Iraq. He says Putin recognized that if the Obama administration wanted out of even a quiet Iraq after so much American investment, it was likely to want out of the Middle East altogether. confirming the aura of weakness implicit in its earlier reset outreach. That's what this outreach program from the beginning conveyed to many of America's enemies. It conveyed weakness. And he saw, with this rush to get out of Iraq, a relatively, as he says there, a relatively quiet Iraq, that if the desire was that strong to leave from there, then the same desire was there to get out of the Middle East altogether. Hansen writes also about the red line invitation into the Middle East. The Syrian red line. You remember this. He writes, Putin was effectively invited into the Middle East when Mr. Obama sandbagged Secretary of State John Kerry's claims that the need to bomb Assad was the moral issue of our time. Obama turned the administration's red line about Syria's use of chemical weapons quite pink. Embarrassed that Syria had dared Obama to enforce his own threats, in denial that Assad's opponents were still being gassed, and reluctant to use force as threatened, given the impending November 2012 presidential election, Mr. Obama simply froze and abdicated responsibility. Putin quickly stepped in, offering his help in dismantling Assad's WMD stockpile. Chemical weapons, of course, have been used repeatedly by Assad well after Putin's fix and never quite left, as Russia's prestige rose and ours sank. Then more recently, there's the Iran deal. Hansen says what Putin saw in the Iran deal was not its cumbersome details or the inflated rhetoric about it, nor did he believe the administration's claims about permanent nonproliferation. Rather, he appreciated the fact that the U.S. had walked back its initial promises to ensure anywhere, anytime spot inspections, zero enrichment, and snapback sanctions. More importantly, upon the conclusion of the deal, the Iranians seemed defiant, the U.S. depressed, and America's friends outraged. In Putin's mind, Hansen says, Iran will become the regional hegemon, eventually going nuclear and playing the berserker part of North Korea in Putin's China-like gatekeeper role. Putin sees where this is headed in the Middle East. He sees that Iran is to be the regional hegemon. And so he's making his move. Finally, more broadly here, he talks about the estrangement from our friends. This has been something we've talked about from the beginning of this administration, going back to early in 2009. Hansen says the Obama administration is more likely to lecture Egypt's General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi than it was Mohamed Morsi. More prone to blast Israel's Netanyahu than Iran's Khomeini. And until recently, more willing to talk of a special relationship with Erdogan of Turkey than with the Kurds. Our allies sense that Obama is much less prone to lash out and employ extra legal remedies against the world's rogue states than against the House Republicans, Associated Tea Party groups, and conservatives in general. America's enemies see this. They see this. These were some excerpts, as I say, from Victor Davis Hanson's piece, The Road to Middle East Perdition. Nature abhors a vacuum, as we know. And nowhere is this more true than in the arena of international relations. The United States leaves, and here you have Iran, here you have Russia rushing to fill the vacuum. It's our lack of leadership that's given way to this Russian advance, to the Iranian advance. Notice Isaiah 3 in verse 1. This prophecy here is aimed at the United States and Britain primarily. In these latter days, it says in verse 1, "For behold, the Lord of hosts does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water." What we're facing here is total disaster. And it's caused by this vacuum. At least that's one prime cause, the lack of leadership. Verse 2 says, "The mighty man, the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the prudent, and the ancient, the captain of 50, and the honorable man and the counselor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator." All these honorable men, all these strong leading men, removed, God says. Gone, God says. Replaced, God says, by children, by those with the mentality of a child, as it says there in verse 4. My father wrote in his Churchill booklet, "We're so childish that we're almost totally unaware of our lack of real leaders. And we fail to see it as a curse." He said, "No great nation can survive without strong leadership." Without strong leadership. Now that's what's interesting to me when you look at, well, it's just another fascinating angle to these developments. When you look at the world today, which it is burning, and yet when you hear America's leaders, you hear so much in the way of optimism, even arrogance, so certain that, as we wrote about a year ago, that everything is just fine. Everything's awesome. Last year, the president said, "America's rarely been stronger." I mean, this was just a year ago. The economy, businesses, innovation, everything. All of this, even as the world burns. Last year, the president's press secretary, we drew attention to this when he said it a year ago. He said, "I think that there have been a number of situations in which we've seen this administration intervene in a meaningful way that has substantially furthered American interests and substantially improved the tranquility of the global community." How much do you think they're thinking about tranquility in Syria today, or Iraq, or Ukraine, or Crimea? You may have seen the report just yesterday, pinning the blame for that airliner that was shot down, brought down by the Russians, which, of course, Russia denies. This is the world we live in. Secretary of State John Kerry said a year ago, "The United States of America has never been more engaged in helping to lead in more places than we are now." These were statements being made when Crimea, when Ukraine were just blowing up in our faces. Today it's the Middle East. Today it's Israel. Today it's Syria. And what are our leaders saying today? Well, let me bring you right up to speed with that. I want to take you back to that discussion at Harvard just last night. This is what the Secretary of State had to say about American leadership.
"I would venture to tell you, and I think it is based in fact, absolutely, that I can't think of a time when the United States of America has been leading in as many places simultaneously, engaged in as many life and death challenges around the world."
He can't think of one time in America's history where America has been leading like it is today. Now, over the weekend, the president was on, I believe it was 60 Minutes. This next clip was an exchange he had with the journalist about Russia, about Putin challenging President Obama's leadership, challenging him in Syria. Notice how this exchange played out.
You said a year ago that the United States, America leads, we're the indispensable nation. Mm-hmm. Mr. Putin seems to be challenging that leadership.
In what way? Let's think about this.
Well, he's moved troops into Syria, for one.
Yeah.
He's got people on the ground.
Right.
Two, the Russians are conducting military operations in the Middle East for the first time since World War II.
So that's bombing
the people that we are supporting.
So that's leading, Steve? So let me ask you this question. When I came into office, Ukraine was governed by a corrupt ruler who was a stooge of Mr. Putin. Syria was Russia's only ally in the region. And today, rather than being able to count on their support and maintain the base they had in Syria, which they've had for a long time, Mr. Putin now is devoting his own troops, his own military, just to barely hold together by a thread his sole ally.
He's challenging your leadership, Mr. President.
Steve, I got to tell you, if you think that running your economy into the ground and having to send troops in order to prop up your only ally is leadership, then we've got a different definition of leadership. My definition of leadership would be leading on climate change and international accord that potentially we'll get in Paris. My definition of leadership is mobilizing the entire world community to make sure that Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. And with respect to the Middle East, we've got a 60-country coalition that isn't suddenly lining up around Russia's strategy. To the contrary, they are arguing that, in fact, that strategy will not work.
My point was not that he was leading, and my point was that he was challenging your leadership, and he has very much involved himself in the situation.
Can you
imagine anything happening in Syria of any significance at all without the Russians now being involved in it and having a part of it?
It's revealing the exchange. It's the same line as they've been saying for the last few years. Russia's isolated. Russia's economy is in shambles. And meanwhile, like Victor Davis Hanson brings out in his column, Russia is on the march. Russia keeps making advances. Same with Iran. And meanwhile, you have leaders in the United States that pride themselves in leading with things like climate change and even holding up the Iranian nuke agreement as a feather in the cap. Iran's already violated the terms of the agreement. This piece from the Washington Free Beacon, just the other day, it says, as it gears up to receive more than $100 billion in sanctions relief under the deal, Iran has already began to ink lucrative arms contracts with the Russians, with the Chinese. This is according to the AFPC, American Foreign Policy Council. Iran's defense budget, some $14 billion annually, is set to grow by at least a third as a result of the sanctions relief, which experts worry, could also be used to fund the fledgling nuclear programs of other nations. So this is what's happening in the real world. And yet U.S. leaders still just rave about their leadership ability. Even as Isaiah 3 is being fulfilled, you look at all these prophecies as they're unfolding. It's exciting to think that we are certainly drawing near to the end of this age. It's also sobering, though, because blindness has certainly set in. within our nations, totally blind to the dangers. When we come back, I just spend the last couple minutes of the program on something a little bit lighter that will hopefully be, that will hopefully just keep us in mind of what we need to be doing in these very dangerous and trying times that we're in. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
I don't have much time to go through this story. It's a New York Times piece. Compulsive texting takes its toll on teenagers. But I just want to bring up a thought here that we discussed yesterday in our editorial meeting. Just about the technology and the increasing amount of time that Americans are spending in front of screens, whether they're laptops or mobile phones, how much more inclined we are to watch videos or to be distracted with surfing the internet and doing so for hours each day. And every study and every new piece that comes out about the impact of this talks about just how much more time we're spending with these gadgets. In this case, how much more time our teenagers, our children, are spending with phones, with mobile devices, texting one another. It says teenagers use text messaging more than any other mode of communication. It says, but youngsters who check their phones continually snap if you interrupt them, and it just kind of goes into some of the common problems of our day. And as we were discussing in our meeting yesterday, with all of these different mediums, I mean, we are working as God's church to reach people in every possible way. But Joel Hilliker, who produces the Trumpet Hour on this station, he pointed out that we also need to be delivering a message to people to cut away from those influences, to make sure that we are studying through some of these fascinating prophecies. Isaiah 3, as we went through in the last segment, all these prophecies with respect to the alliance, the brotherhood, Jerusalem, the powder keg, the clash between the king of the north, the king of the south. What leads up to the return of Christ? All those chapters in the book of Revelation. To really dig into our studies, our spiritual studies, to really get in the prayer time that we need. I talked about this recently. The challenge that Herbert Armstrong, put before those who wanted him to go and speak to the world. That public appearance campaign. He said, all right, I'll do my part, but you've got to do yours. You've got to shut things off and get in your prayer, get in your study. And that certainly is a good admonition for all of us. Right in the midst of the most exciting times, they should be, for any who've ever supported God's work. Right here at the close of this age. That technology is certainly a wonderful thing when it's used right, but it can also be a great distraction. And it's something that we need to talk about more on these programs and write about more at thetrumpet.com, and we'll hopefully be able to do that, and soon. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. Don't forget to send us your feedback, your thoughts about today's program or any of these that we produce. You can send those messages to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us again today, and we'll look forward to seeing you again tomorrow.